Welcome to Mindhead. Welcome to Mindhead. Welcome to Mindhead. Welcome to Mindhead. Welcome
to... Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
People pay good money to see this movie. When they go out to a theater, they want cold sodas, hot popcorn, and no monsters in the projection booth.
Everyone pretend podcasting isn't boring.
Turn it off.
Do you have any experience in motion pictures?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit, actually. I have quite a bit of experience. I'm an active renter, and I attend the film, the cinema, as much as possible, weekly, bi-weekly, inter-week.
Would you be willing to cut your hair?
Oh, yes, but it's usually better if someone else does it. I've had a few accidents.
Would you be willing to show your naked rear end in a movie?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Welcome aboard. Here's your wardrobe. We are over.
How come?
You had sex with Jeff.
So?
Well, I never thought of it that way.
Stay with him, stay with him.
Let go, picture!
Keep it together, keep it together, keep it together! Keep it together, I'm keeping it together!
Awesome. You're gonna be a star.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me once again is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
This film is only for Madagascar and Iran, which do not follow American copyright law.
Also joining us is Mr. Kevin Lahane.
We're not doing anything traditional here. We're working in a new style. We're working in Cinema Nouveau.
We are kicking off a month discussing comedy films with a look at Frank Oz's Bowfinger. Released in 1999, the film was written by and stars Steve Martin as the titular Bob Bowfinger, a struggling filmmaker who, along with his group of misfit artists, makes a movie around the unknowing presence of unstable superstar Kit Ramsey, played by Eddie Murphy. We will be spoiling this film as we go along, so if you don't want anything ruined, please turn off the podcast and go and watch the movie. You can thank us later. So, Rob, when was the first time you saw Bowfinger, and what did you think?
I saw it in the theater when it came out in 1999, and certain lines in this movie have become catchphrases between my friends and I, especially my friend Shane, who I've talked about several times on the film, who I used to work with at the Main Art Theater. We used to go, "Keep it together. Keep it together," and things like that. It was just lovely. I remember seeing it in theater, and this was right at the time. 1999 was the year that I went to Cannes with my silly little low-budget vampire movie. So movies like this, and there was a whole raft of them. We'll talk about this later. In the mid to late 90s, where Hollywood and some independent film started to look at kind of filmmakers, but not good filmmakers. They were looking at low-budget filmmakers or bad filmmakers, and I don't know what the zeitgeist for that is. I think I have a small idea. But for me, being a low-budget filmmaker at that time, and that was still something that I was pursuing 25 years ago, hard to believe, it really resonated that there's this dream, and it's the land of misfit toys, and they're a weird little theater troupe that all get together and want to put on a show. It might be a bad show, but it's for them, and they have fun. And that's what's so beautiful about the film. And I think, which really has a good heart.
And Kevin, how about yourself?
It came out a little later in the year, so I was already at college. I was in my first year of college, where I was going to learn as much as I could about film and screenwriting. And I saw this on a rainy October, and I just loved it. And like yourself, I came away referring to bad seats in the cinema from then on as the Bowfinger seats. And yeah, I remember seeing Return of the King in the Bowfinger seats and feeling like I may as well be watching this film upside down. But yeah, it's a film that I loved. I loved from the moment I saw it. And yeah, it's just become a comfort watch for me. I just go back to it so many times just for the mood that it has and the good nature that it has. It's a rare, perfect comedy.
Yeah, I also saw this theatrically and was very surprised by it, because both Steve Martin was in this like introspective phase of his career with L.A. Story and these movies that just didn't really appeal to me. And I'm sure now if I go back and watch L.A. Story, I would absolutely love it. But at the time, I was like, yeah, no, I'm good. I don't need this. Or what was the George Eliot adaptation that he starred in? It was just like A Simple Twist of Fate or something like that. I was like, yeah, no, I'm good. And then Eddie Murphy was just doing a string of bad films with like Holy Man and Life. And he was definitely already doing the multiple characters in the movie with the first Nutty Professor. And I was like, I don't need this. I don't need two Eddie Murphys. I don't need Steve Martin being introspective. I don't know why I went to see it, but I'm so glad that I did, because I ended up loving it. And I thought that this was a fantastic film. And I know, Rob, you suggested us doing this 6-7 years ago, something like that. So I'm so glad we're finally doing this. I'm glad that we're finally here. I was trying to get Frank Oz or anybody related to the film to be on this episode. Unfortunately, no, because most of the people that are in this film are very talented and very big stars, like Christine Baranski and Heather Graham and even freaking Jamie Kennedy. I mean, everybody is somebody except for, what's the guy's name? Dave, is it? Jack? The star guy who
Cole. He's retired,
drives
actually.
The old car. Yeah, that's, and I'm like, who is this guy? I know he's been in a ton of stuff, but he just reminded me of Chris Klein a little bit. But I'm like, he's not a big name, but everybody else in this movie is, it feels like.
It's interesting with him, because when I was doing my research for this episode, the original star that they wanted for the Eddie Murphy part was going to be Keanu Reeves. And I feel like this guy almost fits that brief of what that character of Kit Ramsey would have been. I can't think of his name.
Cole Suddoth, I think it is.
Slater.
Slater.
Which, like I say, it feels more like a Keanu Reeves type. I hate to say it, Keanu Reeves in that era was the himbo type. Not too bright, good-looking dude with a leather jacket and a t-shirt.
And I think this is the same year that The Matrix comes out. So,
1999.
Really shot him to a different plane once that movie came out.
An incredible year for film, but a very odd year for comedies. Like, when you think of all the really successful comedies of 1999, like the Austin Powers and the Big Daddy and American Pie and things like that, I was surprised that Bowfinger was not as much of a hit as those films. But for me, it has certainly endured a lot longer than those.
Part of it for me, I wonder, is it because it's about filmmaking and we obviously are so much film lovers and deconstructionists, which there's a series of characters I'll talk about later that I love in this movie, that I wonder if it plays to a general audience that doesn't have background in caring about film, like a casual film watcher that watches Bowfinger might be like, oh, it's about making movies, I guess. But if you've actually made a movie or you've read a lot about making movies or into film criticism, there's an extra layer in there for you that I don't know if it plays to a general audience. I don't know. I can't take that part of my brain out and watch it without it.
I think it's because as well that Steve Martin was in a bit of a lull period in his career. Like, I think he'd been off cinema screens for about 3 years before he made this. And the film, the big studio comedy before that was Sergeant Bilko, which I remember seeing a Dennis Penis interview with him, or really a snapshot with him, where he was walking the red carpet for that. And Dennis Penis said to him, hey, Steve, how come you're not funny anymore? And he was devastated by that, totally devastated by it. And Dennis Penis, even with Paul Kay, the guy that performed as that character, says that's the one thing he regrets saying he said, who am I to say that? But I think that's probably part of the genesis of this film, which is Steve Martin retreating a little bit from screens, reverting back to his comedy roots and writing what I consider to be his best film.
There's a extra that comes on the DVD, and he was saying that he had the idea for this probably about 10 years before they actually made the movie, and that once he sat down and he said it was way more complicated than it was, and so once he took it down more to brass tacks, that he was able to knock out the script in, I don't know, less than a month. It's nowhere near as good as a 12-day script called Chubby Rain, but it's pretty good.
Yeah. It's funny how they cut out all of the really boring part of filmmaking, which is the writing of the script. I'm appreciative of that as well.
Because so much of this movie relies on people being smart enough to realize that people are shot at different times when people are making movies. That it's not just all a master shot and then three or four cameras like catching the close-ups or something. This whole idea of the editing, of having Kit Ramsey on one side and then Christine Baranski on the other side, and the way that they're able to marry those two things together, like in the parking lot scene, for example. I hope that people get it. And I know that Frank Oz, the audio commentary for this movie, is fantastic. He's talking constantly. I don't know if people really got that. I hope that they did. There's the stuff happening in the background so much of this movie. Christine Baranski getting a mask put on and she's going to have her fake head created, or Ephraim testing out the melting stuff that is going to happen to him. But they don't foreground that stuff. It's all backgrounded. And Oz himself is like, oh, I don't know if that really worked. But and just hearing him talk about how much stuff they shot and ended up cutting out, and how he used test previews. I think he said they previewed this 8 times and then went back and did a whole bunch of reshoots just to clarify. There's the deleted scenes on the disc as well. And you get to see the entire opening of the movie where Bowfinger is talking about Ephraim's script and all of this stuff and trying to, you know, gather the troops. And he even does the whole thing with the FedEx truck. And then they went back and reshot that whole thing just to make it a lot tighter. Really works very well. And he did that consistently. There's a one scene where Bowfinger is explaining to Jamie Kennedy how they're going to do this with Kit Ramsey, how they're going to make this fake movie, quote unquote. And that is so clear in what he's saying. And that was all reshoots, just because they're like, not really sure if the audience is going to follow this or not.
I have to say, when I watched the deleted scenes to the opening, what I was struck by was how much they changed the tone of the opening. They softened it entirely. And I think that was because where they take the story and how it ends on such a sincere note. The thing that I love about this film is that it's so uncynical for a satire about Hollywood. And the way that it started, I think Frank Oz says in that audio commentary that it began with a helicopter shot over the rich part of LA, all the swimming pools, and you're traveling further and further along to the poor part of town until you come to Bowfinger's cottage. And his first line, as in the deleted scene, then was him coming out and shouting at the sky that I hate this town, I hate rich people. And that, I think, would have pitched Bowfinger in a place of bitterness and frustration, and you wouldn't have been rooting for him as much as you are with the reshot scenes, which are just, they pitch him as this innocent underdog who is still, against all the odds, striving. And you're immediately on his side from that point on. You're like, I'm with this guy and these lovable band of rogues. And as you were saying, Rob, about this sort of this troop of performers that are trying to put on a show, that's tapping into Frank Oz's history with the Muppets, that these guys are almost like live action Muppets, and the ethos of the Henson Company and stuff, it comes true, I think, in spades in this film.
Most definitely. I would say if there's any cynicism, it's not on the plucky low budget filmmakers. The cynicism is with the bigger system. So it's the Jerry Renfro character and the agent, because he plays the agent, and it's with the Scientology satire of Mindhead.
Oh, wait, that's supposed to be Scientology?
Don't say
maybe.
That.
Oh, shit. Oh, they're coming after me now. And then also the disconnect between sort of Hollywood stars and their little bubble that they live in and all of that stuff. That's where they pitch their cynicism, is they pitch their cynicism, if there is any in the film. I'd say it's slight, but it is with that kind of the machinery of the industry, as opposed to the plucky folks who are trying to make it or to do something that they find valuable, even if the system doesn't find it valuable. And I think that really is a beautiful place to be, as opposed to pitching it from the other angle, as you were saying, Kevin. And we can talk about a movie later that does that along similar lines. But just that opening, I really love the opening because it brings us in. It's such a, just through little pieces of audio, just as very simple visuals, we learn real quick who Steve Martin's character is before we actually meet him. We get the idea of the, oh, he was in the community theater and he was doing this and he's doing that and he lives in this kind of, it's not a bad place, but it's a little shabby. And we get the idea, okay, that this is who we're dealing with. And I think that's a much better opening than, I didn't even know this other opening existed until I listened to the audio commentary. And I was just like, no, that would have been.
But it's his performance as well. It's so much more harsh and cutting. He's angry when they pitch it in the first version of the scene, and they soften it so much. And I think that's so vital because he's such a, there's a way that you can view his character as being ruthless and despicable. He's putting people's lives in danger in order to get the shot. And if you get that wrong, if you pitch it at the wrong tenor, then you have a totally different reading on this film. It becomes about a con man rather than a dreamer. And I think that the heart of this story is what elevates it beyond just being a knockabout comedy or a farce. It becomes a story where you're rooting for underdogs to succeed.
And that's the thing that's funny, is because the poster says the con is on and it's got him in this horrible suit coat and he's standing next to Eddie Murphy. There really is this balance that they're trying to strike between being a dreamer and being a con man. And later in the film, of course, he develops a conscience.
When he's talking with Dave, the Jamie Kennedy character, and he's just like, oh, if this goes through, I will buy a new car and you can have my old car. And Jamie Kennedy's, that is my car. Which, reading in the script, I didn't necessarily get it. And then when I rewatched the movie, I was like, oh yeah, that's right. That is his car. But he's not mad about it. He's not just like, oh, you're driving me crazy. Nobody is angry at Bowfinger for being the con man. He's the lovable con man.
But in a lot of ways, and I have to think about sort of Steve Martin's history of characters, this seems to be an archetype that he likes to play, in that he is a very endearing and kind person, but he's also a bit of a rogue. But he's not a mean one. He makes jokes and stuff, but he's not trying to harm people. He's not psychopathic in that way or sociopathic. It's more like, I'm clown.
To go back to what Kevin was saying, it's like the elevation of the Sergeant Bilko character. He's trying to get ahead in the world and trying to pull the wool over everybody's eyes and things, trying to make a lot of money. It's that, but like the softer, gentler side of that. To your point, yes, the poster is misleading, especially with that like Herb Tarlick jacket that he's wearing and pulling the, who's, everybody's like, why is Eddie Murphy dressed that way? Why does he look the way that he looks in this? They luckily go the opposite direction and yeah, make him that lovable scamp. And I love some of the dialogue that he has, like what you're talking about as far as the softness of it. When he's auditioning actors and making them pay to audition, and Heather Graham shows up, is this where I come to be a star? And she goes to write him a check and he's like, no checks. And she starts to cry and he's,
but I don't have any cash on me. I mean, I have cash, but just not on me. And the banks aren't open.
There. There's the door. I'm sorry. We can't let you audition.
That's a pure Steve Martin.
Total Steve Martin. Yes.
His lies as well, they're all coming from a place of well intention, for good intentions. It's like when Slater says to him, do I have it? And he just gives him this look up and down and then goes, sorry, what? I wasn't listening. He's like, do I have it? Yes, you do. Oh, he's lying, but it's just, he's saving his ego. And it's as well when he's celebrating, pretending that he's after getting Eddie Murphy's character, Kit, to star in the film, and they're all jumping up and down and he's like, yay. And he turns the camera and he's just terrified. He's like, how is he going to pull this off? He's like, you're rooting for a liar in that instance because It's despair breaking their hearts, and they're such puppy dogs. All this incredible ensemble, but they're such, they are the Muppets to me. They're just pure innocence and dreamers, and you cannot break their hearts. You have to pull this off because it's going to mean the world to them.
Oh yeah, you can see Scooter is Slater. Miss Piggy is the Carol, Christine Baranski character. Yeah, you totally. Aphram is probably Gonzo. Yeah, you could recast this with Muppets, no problem.
It's funny that you bring up the Muppets because this is the first time I'd ever thought of it. Obviously, Frank Oz and things like that. And this might be, I don't know, I'd have to go back over Frank Oz's films, live action movies. This might be the closest sort of thematically to the Muppets because the Muppets, at least the TV show was always about, we're putting on a show. It's always
the Muppet movie.
It's always
itself.
Backstage.
Yeah.
It's always a backstage performance piece and what goes on between the stage and backstage. So this is the first time I'd ever really thought of that.
No, totally. That a song that they end the Muppet movie on where it's here's the dreamers and all you need is one person to believe in you. And that's what these guys are. It's a troop of underdogs, but there's one thing that I want to call out about Steve Martin for his writing on this is that usually if you have a writer writing a vanity piece, essentially, where they're going to be the star of it, it's a very selfless script. He spreads the jokes around everywhere. So each of this ensemble, they have like several stand-up moments where they're just scene stealing and getting the biggest laughs in the scenes. And I just think that's very commendable and it strengthens the film. There's no superfluous characters in this, which are just the straight man. Everybody is delivering big comedic set pieces. It's a fantastic ensemble comedy in that regard.
Yeah. And we know that Terrence Stamp can do comedy. I'm a big fan of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, but his lines in here where he's just like, Mr. Weenie needs to stay in his pants.
You cannot show it to the Laker girls.
So exactly. Good. And yeah, you're right. There's that whole moment in the Muppet movie where they go in front of Orson Welles and he greenlights the picture. And I like that Bowfinger is clueless at times, especially in that meeting with Jerry Renfro, how he's got the phone, but you can see the cord. And Robert Downey Jr. obviously knows that he's not talking with anybody on the phone. And just that look that he gives at the end is fantastic. I really appreciate him being there and this being, I think, right around the time. I know he's not fully turned things around, but this is a really good Robert Downey Jr. role. Barely in here, but he does a great job of it. And the other thing, talking about ego and Steve Martin, the writer, that he's open to having ad-libs being done. Like Frank Oz would be like, okay, let's do one or two takes and then one for you guys, and you guys can ad-lib. And just that they even set up that whole thing with Jif. And we'll talk about Jif more, but having Jif answering those questions, and some of those were scripted and other things were just thrown out there, and that he was keeping the actors on their toes by throwing in ad-libbing questions. And I don't know what was necessarily in the script versus not in the script that they were asking him, but it just feels very fresh the way that he's answering them. And some of that stuff about him cutting his hair.
Would you be willing to cut your hair?
Oh, yes, but it's usually better if someone else does it.
Whoever came up with it, whether it was Eddie Murphy or Steve Martin, it's just hilarious stuff.
I think it's the scene when Steve Martin rocks up to Eddie Murphy's mansion and he's, I got the script. It's Jiggy Baby. It's butter. It's butter. And that was all improvised. They were just riffing. But also that line or that speech, which has been regurgitated so many times over the years since.
White boys get all Oscars. It's a fact.
We know that, but look.
Did I get a nomination? No, and you know why? Because I ain't playing none of them slave roles. I get my ass whipped. That's when you get the nomination.
That's what
play a slave role, get his ass whipped, you get the nomination. The white boy play an idiot, they get the Oscar. If I should play, find me a script as a retarded slave, then I get the Oscar.
That was all riffing improv from Eddie Murphy, and it's fantastic, and it's become like it changed people's perspective on who gets awarded for what at the Academy.
All those years before Robert Downey Jr. took it to the next level.
Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man, look retarded, act retarded, not retarded. Count two picks, cheat of cards, autistic, sure, not retarded. You got Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump, Slow, yes, retarded, maybe. Braces on his legs. But he charmed the pants off next to him and he won a ping-pong competition. That ain't retarded. He was a goddamn war hero. Right. You know any retarded war heroes? You went full retard, man. Never go full retard. You don't buy that? Ask Sean Penn, 2001, I am Sam. Remember? Went full retard. Went home empty-handed.
I love in that scene with Robert Downey Jr. and Steve Martin, when he's conning him, and when he tells him, you got a green light, and Steve Martin's reaction, where he just goes, okay. He's just, he is like stunned beyond belief, and you immediately just love him. You just feel so, I hope this works out for you, because you're out of your depth here, and you don't realize that you think you're pulling the wool over everyone else's eyes, and you're the one that's being conned here.
The thing that's also funny, and I know this after I made my feature, when I made my silly little feature, we started to go out and talk to people about the next project we want. And we get meetings not too far off from the Robert Downey Jr. meeting, in which no one really wants to tell you because they don't know if you got a fucking great idea that's going to make them tons of money. So they're like, okay, this script's interesting. It's a good idea. Why don't you go out and see who you can get? And if you can get that person, come back to me. I'd love to talk to you about it. Because, like I said, it's the old William Goldman line. Nobody knows anything. So it's going to tell you, fuck off and get the hell out of here. Because no one wants to be the guy who didn't sign the Beatles. There's that story. Oh, I passed. I thought guitar bands were on the way out. So it's, no one wants to be that guy.
Yeah. They'll kill you with kindness in Hollywood.
I love how he looks at the script. Oh, that's interesting. Then it flips to the last page. Gotcha, suckers. Well, there's a catchphrase. And then we cut to Eddie Murphy just a few seconds later. Like, where's my catchphrase? Arnold's got hasta la vista, baby. Where's my catchphrase?
That's right. It's true.
It was so good.
Especially in that era, because it seemed like there were so many action movies. There were so many movies that it was just like people would just repeat these lines to each other. It just became the cool thing.
The thing that I noticed through working in the States and working in the UK is that in the UK, they'll treat you like shit because you're nobody. But in the US, they'll treat you kindly because you might become somebody. It's a stark difference between the two industries.
And it's different. When I worked in radio, I remember in broadcast school, they say, they told us to be kind to everyone because you may work with them going up and you may work with them going down. So as your career does this, just keep in mind, you don't want to rough somebody up because that person who was the intern may end up being your boss some.
I want to talk about Daisy, the Heather Graham character, because she's one of several characters that we see change throughout the film. And hers is probably the most notable, with the exception of some other folks that we'll talk about in a bit here. But her character, the way she dresses, the way her hair is done, who she's with, and just the way that she keeps asking questions as far as like, how do I get more seen? Oh, that person takes care of that. And then she, you know, moves to another person. How can I do this? Oh, that person. Okay. Then she moves to another person and she is perfect for Bowfinger. I love that she is as conniving, but also sweet at the same time. Doesn't really purposefully hurt people. Doesn't go out of her way to hurt them, but you can see the look of
she's upfront disappointment. About being a climber.
Oh, yeah. But you see that look of disappointment, like when she moves from Ephraim to Bowfinger, and he's just like, oh, okay. But then there's another person behind him who she's already slept with, and just the way she goes up and up, and that when she sleeps with Jif, and he's so excited, and then that argument, quote-unquote, yeah, that she and Bowfinger have.
We are finished. We are over.
How come?
You had sex with Jif.
So?
Well, I never thought of it that way.
I'll see you tonight.
What time?
8.
Okay.
That is, again, another wonderful Steve Martin moment. And that, yeah, at the end of the movie, she's there with Kit. But I'm so surprised that she's actually in the Kung Fu movie at the very end of the film.
Did you know that she was modeled on Anne Heche?
No.
That's where the inspiration came from. That she was like climbing all the way up until she became involved with the most powerful lesbian in Hollywood, Ellen DeGeneres.
That's funny. That's funny.
And Hesh is also from Ohio. So that's one of the observations I think that Steve Martin made about Anne Heche.
When Anne Heche came out as bisexual, or she might have even gone full lesbian. It was just like, what? More power to her. I'm not going to, you know, question her sexuality, but there was like, is this a power move? What are you doing?
All the characters have layers to them.
Onions have layers. Ogres have layers. Onions have layers. You get it.
But she's the one which is, she's in on it and she's aware of it. And she's not the dumb blonde that you think she is. Like the other characters that have that great transformation as well. They lose their wide-eyed naivete and they become players within the system very quickly.
Since we're talking about that arc of her character, do you want to talk about the other set of characters that have an arc there?
Who weren't even in the script. I was so surprised that the whole thing with we're going to get the best crew money can buy. That line and the payoff to that, it's one of the best laughs in the movie. And then to see the Mexican crew that he gets, those four guys, and to see their transformation through the film, holy cow, so good.
I have to say, on this watch, I can't remember the last time I saw it, maybe at least a decade or so, but on this watch, the way that it's staged with the cliche Mexican music, and they're in the middle of the desert, and they're just shoving people into the van, I was like, I cringed a little. Like, I was thinking of a similar, and this is Robert Downey Jr. again, where when you first hear Robert Downey Jr. in blackface, Tropic Thunder, and then you see Robert Downey play that character and why, you're like, okay, that works. But the first reaction to it is, we're not going where we need to go. But when we get to the end, and I love the fact that right before the end, they're sitting around, they've been on the crew, they've been shooting and all this stuff, and they're debating great cinema, they're reading Kaidi cinema. They've become film nerds like us, basically. So you've got nothing but mad respect for the
It says that with hard work and tenacity, you can become the most in-demand film crew in Hollywood. You can work your way up. So it's affirming and it's positive. And yeah, again, it's just all the characters have their moments, and it's just so good-natured that it starts off from a place of desperation on Bowfinger's part. And then just in the background, you just see them evolve to the point where they're talking about Kubricking lenses, and they've got their mobile phones and they're dressed really slick. It's lovely. You just love to see that. And that just is the undercurrent of the whole film, is that there's joy seeing these people rise up and pull it off. It's such a crowd pleaser.
In essence, they've surpassed Bowfinger by the end of the film. Like, they are the ones that their phones are ringing. Obviously gets the FedEx at the end of it, which is fantastic for him. And I love how it's all shot in slow-mo and just presented like this magical moment and everything. But they're the ones that are going to be working steadily now for the rest of their lives. They're the ones who in 20 years I'll try to be contacting for interviews for this show.
It's funny you say that, but when I was watching the film, I was thinking about how different Bowfinger would be if it was made today, and whether Bowfinger himself would have a podcast, whether that would be his psychic. No, but the difficulty for him to pull off making this film, it'd be a much easier. He'd be Neil Breen today. He'd be doing it himself with like green screen and starring as all the different parts. And
you can do it now a lot easier. You can be that one man band, because I don't hear about Neil Breen's crew very often. I'll have to tell you that. Unless Neil Breen is the crew.
ChatGPT.
Which then becomes true, because he says in here, he's got the line, he goes, every movie costs $2,184. So it's
after 10% of the deferred nut or whatever. Yeah.
One of my favorite movies we did on the show cost $100 to make. If you've never seen Flooding with Love for the Kid, do yourself a favor.
I was glad that one thing from the script got dropped, which was the counting of the money. And it's almost like a ticking clock for the movie, because he's got all of his money, it's rolled up in the springs of his bed, and it's this whole scene of him and Dave, and they're getting the money and all this, and it just becomes much more of a big thing, because that scene is still there, but it's the context is a little bit different. And then, of course, when he gets Daisy's credit card and just starts buying all the real equipment, charging all the real equipment. And I was glad to the stuff with the security guard, who is a member of Mindhead. That is a much longer piece in the script as well. Like from the first time Dave takes one of those cameras, you have the guard who's watching him and it becomes like this investigation. I was just like, I don't need that. I just need the one scene at the end where the guard notices and happens to be a member of Mindhead. And I love Mindhead. I love all of the design around Mindhead, the pyramid stuff, the pyramid type building, the huge picture of Terrence Stamp with all of the people next to it, like all those faces, almost Rupert Pupkin-esque. But it just, I love that. And the rules that they have for Kit and how he's like Kit's personal counselor. I always like those scenes between those two.
Mindhead's building, which I guess is an actual design center in Los Angeles, I think is actually nicer than I used to tell people, if you ever just want to have fun, you have no money, just go to the Scientology Center and you're in LA. Take their little test and take their little tour, because it's fun just to go, oh my God. But Terrence Stamp in here is, if you want to talk about a straight man, it's the play, which the straight. But the whole thing with the auditing, with him, every time he says gonads.
Oh God, yes.
Buzzes. But the happy premises are just brilliant.
It seems as though you're doing much better.
Yes, yes.
Your paranoia is definitely under control since you came to understand happy premise number one.
Happy premise number one, there are no aliens.
Happy premise number two.
Happy premise number two, there is no giant foot trying to squash me.
Happy premise number three.
Happy premise number three, even though I feel like I might ignite, I probably won't.
So, what do we do?
Keep it together. Keep it together, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together.
And what is it we don't do under any circumstances?
Oh, man.
What is it?
Look, I have to show it to the Laker girls.
You cannot show it to the Laker girls. Keep Mr. Weenie in the pants. Always in the pants. I know you want to show it to the Laker girls, but you must never show it to the Laker girls.
At the same time, it is making fun of Scientology, but I'd have to say even that is lighthearted. That's a cynical takedown of people who are into alternative ideas who are part of the Hollywood establishment. It's just lightly poked.
They could just be CAA for... under a different guise. It's they're protecting their client or their cash cow. It doesn't have a mean bone in its body, this film, which is why that opening, the original opening, was so surprising that they pitched it at the wrong tenor in the beginning. But it's so sweet. And yeah, it's a very fleet film. There's no fat on this. Every single scene is pushing the story forward. And it's doing that without compromising the comedy. It's like sometimes for feel-good films, they can just have this lull period where it just becomes about like the second act where everything goes to shit and everybody's falling out with each other and they're all sad and then somebody has to have a heart-to-heart moment. This doesn't have that. It manages to swerve all of the hacky tropes of someone calling cut and then you see that it's a scene and it's not an actual moment from the film and you don't see any of Steve Martin's films up to this point. It manages to be really succinct and economical and very funny and still tell a cracking story. It's the writing of this film is the real star of the show for me. It's so well written.
The arithmetic of this film, the moment that they find out that Jif, the Kit Ramsey lookalike that they've found and hired, that he's the brother of Kit Ramsey, when we find that out, and then suddenly it's like Bowfinger has this crisis of conscience and it's just, oh my God, I can't use this guy anymore. This is terrible. I'm an awful person. Next scene, Jif comes in. He's just like, guess who I slept with? And then that like suddenly takes that shift of power and balances it back out again. And so then next thing, Bowfinger's like, okay, I need you to run an errand. I want you to go to, you know, Starbucks. I want you to do this. I want you to call your brother, find out where he's going to be on Friday. I want you to go and grab a box of pencils, and I want them to be really sharp. And just, he is treating him a little bit differently, but at the same time, he doesn't care. And he's just going to go on, and he has to get this movie made. And he might treat Jiff a little nicer after that, but yeah, he still has to get this film completed.
It gives us and it gives him permission to be really reckless and dangerous in the scene with him risking his life to cross the freeway. That's the other thing, is that the comedic set pieces in this film are so laugh out loud funny that you don't really need to understand much about filmmaking in general. Or I know that Frank Oz was struggling to put that across, teach people how a film is made. But if you can just buy into the fact that they're pranking Eddie Murphy's character, whether he's Kit or Jiff, it's just gut-bustingly hilarious. I remember watching the film on DVD with my mom, and she wouldn't have a clue about any of the stuff. She's never read anything I've written. She wouldn't even know like how a film is made. But just seeing Eddie Murphy walk through a parking garage and a dog is pursuing him in high heels and he thinks he's being stalked and he's losing his mind and he's wailing and trying to scare it off with these kung fu noises. It's just hilarious. Like, it's pure slapstick comedy. It's brilliant.
That freeway scene always makes me laugh. And the thing that's interesting was I didn't realize that they staged it in two different manners. And now that I listen to the audio commentary, I'm like, oh, okay, that's how they did it. I didn't realize that part of it was actual cars and with a really long lens. So there was no danger. And then the other part was all digital. But given the fact that this is 25 years old digital, it doesn't look like digital.
Does not look like fake cars whatsoever. I think that's, sorry to pull the Detroit card here, but I think that's one of the advantages of cars, is that we've been using 3D models of cars and commercials and things for so long that they look really good and you can make them look really good on film. So many of the cars that people see driving around in commercials today, it's all 3D. It's all just CGI creations.
And also, given the fact that they're going fast, they're blurred, so they don't have to be that good, you know what I mean? But still, it's even to the eye, I'm like, this looks like traffic. And then the sound, especially with a freeway, if you live in any place with a freeway like that, woof, it has a certain sound, and they totally captured it, and it just adds to the peril you feel for him. He's basically playing Frogger in the middle of the freeway.
The sound of that, the sound of the high heel shoes, like Kevin was just talking about, that makes the scene, is that the high heel shoes, and when you get the reveal that it's Betsy the dog wearing the shoes. And that's one of the weird things about the movie, I do have to say, is that before he tells them about Kit Ramsey being on board the film, he has to show that Daisy can do that come here and stay thing. But, and then they're like, and he's like, oh yeah, no, Kit said yes. And I'm like, we had to show that thing with Betsy? That was very odd, but she was a great canine actress, and really just appreciate what she brings to it, especially just her laying on the couch with her legs spread wide open in such an unladylike pose. I'm constantly on my dog, just like, which is, yeah, a little decorum, please. Come on.
I just like the rubber band. He goes over and rubber bands them together.
But it's also a gorgeous looking film. You're talking about the look of it there. I think of the other studio comedies of the era, this one just looks, it looks so Californian, like that golden hue that's basking the scenes, and there's so many shadows, and it's dynamically shot. It just looks sumptuous. Like they haven't scrimped on that. It's not shit. It's not shot like a sitcom, which I appreciate.
In that they're doing all of that stuff in his office on a set, and that it looks like real sunlight coming in from outside. Really well done.
That was amazing to me. I didn't realize that was a set. The lighting was so good. The architecture inside of the place looked realistic. It looked lived in. Kudos to set creator and set design and all of on this film. It just looks lived in that way.
All those little pieces of paper that you're talking about, the flyers for former Bowfinger productions, the posters on the wall, all of that stuff I thought was great. I love that he's got Touch of Evil on the wall, talking about another very frustrated filmmaker.
Can we talk about Eddie Murphy double role movies, please? Can we just have a little moment to talk about when they work really well and when they don't. And obviously, I would say this one is one of the better ones up there with Coming to America. Coming to America set the standard for him. Now, for a long time as a kid, I didn't know where this kind of came from. I didn't know why Eddie Murphy was doing these double roles. Obviously, when I was young and I first saw Coming to America, I wasn't aware of things like The Nutty Professor, the original one with Jerry Lewis. I don't even think I had seen when Coming to America came out. I don't think I had seen Dr. Strangelove yet. But I think it was, I read somewhere that Eddie Murphy was very influenced by Peter Sellers and doing these multiple roles in films, especially the Pink Panther series. To me, this one, I think, I don't know how many of there, 7 or 8 movies that he's done double roles?
I don't know. That's a good question. For me, it all goes all the way back to when he was Mr. White on Saturday Night Live, and just that embracing of the prosthetics and the makeup and just to transform himself into a white guy. Probably one of the best looking transformations, way better than that bizarro, uncanny White Chicks movie that the Wayans brothers were in. Those blue contacts still haunt me today.
That White Like Me segment reminds me of course, a film we've done on the show many years ago, Watermelon Man. And I thought Godfrey Cambridge, that was a good 10 plus years before Eddie Murphy did that White Like Me segment. Pulled that off really well.
You got to walk with your butt real tight.
I was explaining this to a coworker recently who's younger than me, who had never seen this bit. And I was like, go look it up. It's so good. The Eddie Murphy White Like Me segment on Saturday Night Live.
I think it probably speaks to Eddie's genius, really, as a performer. The fact that he can slip into these roles so easily and he can mimic so many other different types of personalities that I think he would get very bored if he just had to play it one type for a whole film, because he's done it successfully before. So whenever I see these fantastic filmmakers who end up dismantling their process and just making terrible films, but it's a new way for them to see if they can make a film, I think that probably motivates a lot of the Eddie Murphy impulse to switch it up and try and play a woman or an old man or a fat chick or whatever. But in this one, he's so restrained. It's just his persona. It's his energy himself. It's not an effects-driven sort of transformation. It's his essence. He's just entirely transformed in both roles, and he manages to make both of the characters really endearing and sweet. They're not irritatingly stupid or aggressively obnoxious. There's just a nugget of humanity to both of them where you end up even like rooting for them to, I don't know, get through the predicament that they're in.
It's like they want things at opposite ends of the spectrum. And that's the thing that's so funny about the two brothers, is that Kit wants to be the biggest star. He wants to be bigger than Arnold. He wants to be all that. And then Jif's just like, oh man, I would just love to run errands. I just want to do something very simple. Oh, that'd be great. Cause I know when I go get the coffee, that's me. I went and got that for them. Just very simple.
It's when he's looking at Heather Graham and she takes her top off in front of him. And he's like a little boy. Oh. He's grinning and he's like,
awesome.
You've got to be a star.
You've got to be a star.
You're doing great. And so I think Heather Graham is the perfect foil for that, because she's just got this sort of magnetic, like doe-eyed. It's like she's a Playboy bunny. Just she's just enchanting to watch. She just plays these gullible idiots so well, and yeah, it just makes that scene that they've cast this film so well, like across the board.
And I was thinking around the same time, and this was, I think, maybe a year before, the only other movie. It's a movie where she plays someone making a movie, and it's similar but different, is Boogie Nights. But in there, she's much more realistic, and then it gets darker as it goes. And the fact that she basically plays ingenue in two different films but doesn't play the exact same character, in here she's much more of a, like you were saying, oh, I'm just this. I love her line in here where it's, I may be from Ohio, but I'm not from Ohio. It's that. It's, I can be naive Midwestern, but I have knowledge of my naivete, quote unquote.
You can see the gears turning in her head in the scenes. She's always watching and observing and seeing where the angle is. And it's a fantastic performance.
Definitely is. And I love that it's, if Kit Ramsey wasn't as unstable as he is in real life, this whole thing wouldn't have worked nearly as well, but that they just happen to pick a person who thinks that he's being plagued by aliens, is receiving messages from the Laker girls that they want to see his penis, just all of these things that make him unstable, and that they just play right into it with showing up, talking to him, calling him this other name, leaving. It's like he's being tormented almost by ghosts in this movie, especially Christine Baranski when she shows up and she's like, oh, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but I'm really looking forward to having sex with you later.
And I'm really glad that paranoia is not known to anyone making the film, because a more obvious choice would be they decide they want to get him. So there may be a scene where they go get all the supermarket tabloids or something about this person, and they're reading up on him, trying to figure him out. And there's maybe, I don't know, Weekly World News or National Enquirer or something talking about, oh, he believes in aliens and all these things. And there's none of that. It's just, he's an actor. We just want this actor. And just by virtue of trying to sneak him into their film clandestinely, they just trigger all of this stuff that he deals with.
Yeah, there's no shoe leather in the story. The other thing that I love about the script is they introduce characters when they have the maximum effect in the story. They don't fall into that trap of, like, you have to introduce all the main players in Act One. Characters appear when they're going to change the trajectory of what's happening. So it's like Kit Ramsey when he gets introduced, or when Heather Graham's character comes into it. It's a very well-written script, again, to reiterate my point.
There was another deleted scene, which is Bowfinger trying to find the address of Kit Ramsey, and he goes to all of these different dry cleaning places and keeps asking how much it costs to launder a shirt. And he finally gets to a place. He goes to one, it's like $2.50. Another one's, I don't know, $8. He goes to one, and it's just this futuristic, like, empty white space with this Asian lady sitting behind a desk with a television monitor on one side where you can see the plastic bags just rotating. And she has one button on the desk. And he's like, how much do you charge to launder a shirt? $25. I'm here to pick up Kip Ramsey's dry cleaning. And she just hits that button. And then just sits there, and it's so uncomfortable as we're waiting for the dry cleaning to come out. And finally, he finds the address. We didn't need any of that stuff, and I was glad that they cut that out. But at the same time, it was a neat little scene that they kept in there for the deleted scene. So I was glad for that. But yeah, to your point, Kevin, this script just moves along so quickly, and they know exactly when to introduce those characters and when to get them going. I mean, when Kit Ramsey shows up, we see a poster on a building at one point beforehand. We hear his name a few times, but then we finally see him. And then when Jif comes into the story later on, again, it's at the perfect place. Like, we are right there for all of these beats. And to your point from earlier, there is no second act lull where we're just like, okay, when are we going to get back here? When are we going to...
Yeah, the band breakup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everybody hates Bowfinger all of a sudden, and now he has to go back and get them all back again. No, I'm glad that there is not that romantic comedy breakup moment.
Don't you just miss that? Fleet comedies that were 90 minutes long rather than 2 hours and 20 minutes.
That's the old John Waters line. I remember him saying, no comedy should be over 90 minutes. He goes, because no one ever says, do you want to hear a joke? And then it just goes on forever. I went and saw someone do a stand-up set, and it was, they were still workshop, wasn't ready yet. And it went on for like 2 hours, and I just got so exhausted by it. And this is a rather well-known comic who does specials, and I was just like, this isn't funny anymore. And I think part of it is horror comedy has build and release, and you just can't keep working that muscle so many times before you just, it wear out an audience.
I remember feeling watching the Austin Powers film. I think it was the third one, Goldmember, and it was hilarious, but it just kept going and going. And after a while, it becomes unpleasant. We're just exhausted. You're exhausted by the amount of jokes which don't work, and they just keep going and keep going. But this is clockwork precision. They've cut out great jokes in order to make the totality of the story support the jokes that it has, and it becomes just a pleasurable experience from beginning to end.
It's the P word, pacing. It's all about pacing. And that was the thing that was amazing to me. Like I said on that, you had mentioned on the audio commentary already that Frank Oz had 8 test screenings and he took notes and he figured, okay, this needs to be a little longer, this needs to be a little shorter. This is the first time I've ever heard really a filmmaker talk about the test screening process and actually have good things to say about it. A lot of them are just like, oh, fucking test screenings are horrible. This fucking audience doesn't know anything. Fuck them. And just really just rip the shit out of test audiences. But Oz obviously gets a lot. I don't know if he got a lot out of throughout his entire career, but definitely in this film in terms of taking into account how the audience was reacting. And I thought that was really interesting in terms of the process.
It feels like comedies benefit a lot more from the test screenings than maybe an action film or drama or something where you're more internal. But with comedies, you have that external reaction. You have the laughter. And he being Frank Oz, is able to hear that and to write down, okay, yeah, this worked, this didn't work, and really just, like you said, fine-hue everything in this script and in this film in order to maximize those laughs. It's very similar to like the ZAZ guys. They would do the same thing.
I found it fascinating when he spoke about the beginning of the film on the audio commentary and that the audience didn't know why they were seeing these scenes where he was going to find Robert Downey Jr.'s restaurant in order to dupe him into reading his script and what have you. And he felt the way to tell the audience that you can relax, that the film knows it hasn't started yet, is to put music over that. And it changed the whole energy of the first act. It was fascinating to hear a filmmaker talk about practical applications of how you can manipulate or condition the audience to know that, yes, we're aware that the story hasn't kicked in yet. We're still in the setup stage. So we're going to have music play over this and make it into more of a montage and skillful direction.
That was another thing I was glad that they dropped from the movie is that car, the one that Jerry Renfro was talking about. Oh, yeah, this is the only one in L.A. and all this. And of course, Dave ends up liberating it because he's a valet, and we have Slater driving it later on in the film, and we see him drive it a few times, and then you see Jerry Renfro in the theater looking up at that car, and he gets this puzzled look on his face. In the script, he actually sees that car and is like, I can't have another one of those around that I don't own, and he ends up buying his own car back from the movie people, and it's just, yeah, how quickly are you going to find out about that? And there's pink slips and all these kind of things. I'm just like, no, leave that alone. And I was glad that they did. They just needed that look on his face in the theater when they're having their huge moment of triumph. And that one shot where you get Kit and Jif next to each other is the only time that we're doing that kind of double screen thing. And I was glad that we limit that so much because we don't need Jif and Kip to ever talk in this movie. And I love that, going back to what you're saying, Rob, as far as the doubling of stuff, it's so simple, the doubling of these characters. And it's much more that physicality of Jif versus Kit that you have. Kit is so close to an Eddie Murphy regular role. And then Jif, luckily, and I know Frank Oz even said, I don't want a lot of prosthetics. I don't want this to be, you know, completely different. He does have to look enough like Kit Ramsey to fake Kit Ramsey, but he pulls it off so well with just the ears sticking out a little bit, the braces, the glasses, but just even the way that he holds his eyes when he's not wearing his glasses. And when he's doing the fighting at the end in that Taiwanese Kung Fu film, just the way that he's moving his arms, just like a spaz.
He's terrified of getting hit.
It's so fun. And those stunt guys just go flying away when he just like moves his arm, waves it around a little bit, and they fly off across the room. So good.
Which, as I rewatch that, now knowing that one of Eddie Murphy's more recent films that he did, Dolomite, it has this kind of chop-socky, horrible, low-budget kung fu movies.
But for me, what sets the film over the top is the premiere at the end, when they've pulled it all off and they're all sitting there and they're watching the film play out, and it's just the pushings on their faces, and they've done it. It's so sincere and sweet, and I just love the fact that it went there, that it didn't try and layer it with so many levels of irony, or it didn't try and be glib or try and diffuse it. It just pushed in on Steve Martin's face and just allowed us to feel what he felt, which is just awe and joy. And it's so sweet. I just love it for that. It always chokes me up because it's so sincere and because it's wearing its heart on its sleeve.
And can I also talk about in that scene, I love the fact that he doesn't go with Heather Graham's character. I feel actually that he belongs with Christine Baranski's character. I think that would have been an extra piece in the script where it's finally they realize that we're misfits and we should be together and they're more appropriate for each other in certain ways. But I just love her in this. She's so good. Like I say, she did a lot of TV sitcom work, but her work in here is great. I think the first time I ever saw her, I believe, was in The Ref, where she plays the mother. Yeah.
Great film.
Of In the Family. And she's just perfect in that. It's one of my favorite holiday comedies. But I just always have thought she's just a great actress.
I was trying to find out if this is true or not, but there was a moment where she's driving around and she sees Kit and she goes to stop. It's when he's basically shilling for clothes, like when he's got this one of his entourage wearing the suit. Okay, do the thing. And he holds up the face of Kit Ramsey in front of his own face. Yeah, I look good in that.
I like that.
It's so good. But when she's driving around in that scene, there's music playing on her radio. I swear it's to God, singing. It's her singing.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah. I was looking for that in the credits and I was like, is that, I'm not crazy. Yeah. Cause she just seems so full of herself, but in a lovable way. Like she could be the most insufferable character in this movie because she's so much about the craft and all this. And she ends up being so super sweet. It's really nice.
My biggest guffaw that I got on a rewatch, because I remember all the big moments, but it's the little ones that just catch you off guard. And it's when Bowfinger is laying out the plan and it's you only get one take with Kit and she goes, one take? It's the horror of what? It's the way that she just delivers such a throwaway line, but I just guffawed because, there's nothing funnier to me than somebody lying and trying to hold on to a lie and keep a secret and duping others. And she's hilarious. She's always criticizing other people where it's like Robert De Niro couldn't play this role. She's like, oh, he annoys me.
Going back to that premiere, of course, I was reminded so much of Ed Wood when I was watching that. And there are quite a few times throughout this movie where I was just like, this lovable band of losers making a movie despite all odds and really in a very illegal way. Like when the cop pulls up and you get that great, I think Frank Oz calls it the back of headline. Have you ever thought about being an actor? But yeah, that whole idea of these lovable losers who are doing this illegal filming so reminds me of Ed Wood. And to your point, Rob, as far as like movies about movies, it feels like that really kicked off a movement in the 90s.
I was thinking about this as I was watching this, because basically between about 1995 and 2000, there is at least a half dozen movies specifically about movie making and the backstage and front stage of movie making. And also not just movie making, big budget movies, but low budget and bad movie making. And so I have to say it probably is Ed Wood that really kicked it off. A little bit before that, but a little bit artier about the backstage process a little bit, although it's not really on the set, is The Player. And I was thinking about maybe Altman opened up the whole thing about agents and the process kind of thing. But really, I think it was Ed Wood that did it. And then for me, following right after that, and I can't remember which one came out first, I'd have to look at release dates, is Bowfinger has a lot of similarities to Get Shorty in that the Harry Zim character is Bowfinger. He's this low budget guy and he's got this little office and all that stuff. And then the movies that we've done on the show, and this is the cynical one.
They're all cynical though. I think all the films about Hollywood and filmmaking
But this one is the really cynical one, is my good friend Lloyd and Terra Firma. And when he made that one, you can obviously tell that Lloyd's fucking pissed. He's just, I've been making these low budget movies for 20 years. I don't make any fucking money. Everything sucks. Hollywood's run by a bunch of fucking idiots, and I've got to make, I'm a playing a blind film director making a low budget movie. Terra Firma, go watch that and listen to that. But I was also even thinking about documentary and how another really quotable film is American Movie, and about the guys in Wisconsin trying to make this low budget horror movie. There must have just been something in the water in that period. I don't know what it was that for some reason there was just a bunch of filmmakers that wanted to make movies about low budget filmmaking.
I wonder if it was a reflection of the indie boom that was happening. I mean, starting in 92, I'm trying to think of, so you have like Blood Simple, you've got your Sex, Lies, and Videotapes, you've got your Reservoir Dogs, and like those movies really start to reshape Hollywood, and it becomes much more of the, what was it called, the Slackers, Dykes, Mikes, and Spikes of the world. I can't remember the name of the book, but you've got like the Robert Rodriguez's and all of these folks that are coming up. I'm thinking that it's a reflection of that, with look at how easy or difficult it is to make a movie and how you need all of this spirit to do it. Living in Oblivion, it's amazing to me that Living in Oblivion is 95, same year as Ed Wood and Get Shorty. It's like that movie is already parodying making these independent films. There's even that line.
You know, the only reason I took a part in this movie is because someone said that you were tight with Quentin Tarantino!
Which was allegedly based on, I think, Brad Pitt or something. Now that I think about it, Mike, I really do think that it probably was related to that, because that was when I was in high school, and I remember discussions about, oh, we like Clerks, we made this on our credit card, or we snuck these shots. So it was much more of a move away from everything being studio bound, big budgets, and all of these things. And I think took people into movie making in a way, that whole kind of Sundance raft, basically from Sex, Lies forward, so 89 forward, really brought the scale of film down and made it more accessible. So I think probably you're right.
I like to hear that.
That you're right? Oh, absolutely. You're always right. What are you wrong?
Living in Oblivion actually has probably the truest representation of what it's like to make a film, where he has that moment where Catherine Keener gives this incredible performance and there's no film in the camera. And then when they have to do it again, she can't recapture it. And it's that moment is just gone, and the heartache and heartbreak of that. But also you had lots of films at the time that were about very literate characters, like the Scream films, where they're film fans. You wouldn't really have films about characters who were aware of films in general. They almost used to just exist in this bubble. So yeah, it was just everyone was quite literate in the 90s, and postmodernism, and I suppose peeling back the curtain and the charade and the facade of filmmaking in general, I think was probably rife for send-up.
The whole thing with the Scream films and that postmodernism, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact you and I, Mike, both worked in one, video stores. And because of everything shifted to, well, we can just watch tapes, we can just rent tapes, we can get into backlogs of all this stuff and really become extremely film literate. And you can see where that leads.
Leads only to madness.
It leads to podcasts.
Exactly. And especially in our current era, the audience was much hipper in that way. So I think it probably is that combination, as you guys were pointing out, was the Sundance indie boom. And then also just people were more film literate thanks to VHS and home video.
It was cinema nouveau.
Good way to take it right back to the beginning.
Moving beyond just riffing on low budget indie film in that period in the late 90s, 2000s, what other films about filmmaking do you like? Would you recommend to someone if they're into film?
I don't particularly like watching films about filmmaking because it's so naff to me. It's that very recently there was that film by Judd Apatow, The Bubble, and it was just like, it's such low-hanging fruit. We've got the pretentious actor and the tortured director and the conniving producer, and it's all about like how superficial and dumb it is to make a film, and it just feels like it's so obvious that it's not funny or it's not enlightening. There's nothing to really say about anything with that. It's snake eating its own tail. So for me, it's when they go so far outside the realm of making a film that it becomes about the characters that would inhabit that world, the types of people. So like Tropic Thunder, where you're pulling them out of making a film and seeing how they cope with the reality of the situation, or Three Amigos, or Galaxy Quest, where it's the archetypes in an unfamiliar situation and trying to continue with the delusions that they have. That's where I find those types of characters the most entertaining, really.
Those are all really excellent choices. For me, I was thinking about Contempt, like Godard's Contempt, but really the other guy, Truffaut's Day for Night.
So depressing, though.
Is really good. I like it, though. It's just me. But the one that has always stuck with me, and it's this, I don't know if either of you have seen William Greaves' Symbiopsychotaxoplasm. It's this layering of, they're trying to make a film, and then there's a documentary about the film taking place at the same time, and then there's this third layer. It's an odd film. It is experimental in the best way that I can think of it. And this is 1968, when this movie was made. If you're interested in sort of these layers of kind of meta media discussion, I think Symbiopsychotaxoplasm is probably worth your time. And I'm not doing it justice by explaining it, because I don't think you can. I think it's a movie that you really have to see in its own form.
What's weird, I guess I like one that's more tangential to it, because I always go back to Sunset Boulevard when it comes to movies about making movies, but so little of it takes place on a soundstage and they never get the movie made. But that whole quest to make this new version of Salome that Norma Desmond is going to star in, and more of the old days and talking about that, the whole Waxworks things with the silent actors who are cast aside, Buster Keaton and whatnot. That's probably my favorite movie about making movies, even though, like I said, it's more in the background of that.
My favorite movie about making movies is Bowfinger.
Ringing us around. Yes. Again.
Glad you were on this episode.
No, but it genuinely, I just find it disinteresting to me. It's like the things that I love about this film is that it doesn't do the obvious. It doesn't have that tortured, I've said it already on this episode, but like a more cleaner take of it would probably be, you open with some chaos happening on screen and then someone yells cut and you're on a set. And it's, I've seen that hundreds of times at this stage. It's never funny. And I'm glad that Bowfinger doesn't fall into those traps.
And speaking of, and I think this might be part of the reason why when I saw this movie, I was like, it's good, but it feels, didn't really, it was Hail Caesar. Hail Caesar feels like that, where it's, I expected better of the Coen brothers in certain ways. It's good, but it's not great. It has this, it does that kind of thing where there's a big scene and then cut, whistle, what's going on? We're on the set. And then there's all these personalities that the Josh Brolin character has to interact with and deal with and all their various intricacies. And I just felt like it didn't elevate for me. And granted, I haven't seen it since it was in the theater, so I only saw it once, but I haven't gone back to it, which is rare because Coen Brothers movies, I've
seen. What was that film about the making of Hitchcock? That was interesting.
I think it was just called Hitchcock, yeah, wasn't it?
So the making of The Birds, was it?
Or no, Psycho? It was the one with Scarlett Johansson where she was playing Janet Leigh and Helen Mirren was Mrs. Hitchcock. And I think it was either Alfred Hitchcock.
Because there were two Hitchcocks,
yeah, the same time,
right around the same time. Yeah, because it was
the one with Anthony Hopkins.
There was Anthony Hopkins and there was it Toby Jones was the other one?
Yeah, he always tends to get the deep impact of the Armageddon role in those films. Capote or whatever.
Yeah, I can't remember what the name of that one was. It's funny when you talk about movies, the very first episode of this podcast was The Stuntman. And yeah,
that film's
that
insane.
I think might have, you're right, that might have that, oh, we're on a movie set moment, but it just works for me. That whole movie works really well. And going back to the Coen brothers, I mean, after they gave us Barton Fink, it's like, that is so perfect. Talk about tortured artists, but an artist that you almost want to see tortured because I don't like Barton Fink as a person, and I like when he's being tortured. And
it will show you the life of
the mind.
Would found footage even count because you've taken it into the hands of like regular people making their own film. Perhaps not.
I hate found footage movies so much of the time. Like, there's some good ones, I will grant you that. But so much of the time, the conceit of this actually being a found piece of media, somehow VHS, film, whatever, it loses.
Are you seeing that, this?
Yeah, it loses it so quickly. And just the VHS movies, I'm just like, first off, this doesn't look like VHS. And second off, who is editing all this stuff together? If this is shot on a VHS camera, you've got one camera. How are we doing all these multiple angles here? So, yeah, there are a few good ones that are out there, definitely. But for the most part, I'm just like, oh, it just drives me crazy. Like when what was that one that was supposed to be, the Survival of the Dead, one of those George Romero later films where it was just
Diary? Yeah, Diary of the Dead.
And it's just like, who's setting up all these lights everywhere? Why we're out on this road at night? How come there's so many lights everywhere?
I haven't seen it in 20 years, but I always felt that of the found footage, I always thought Blair Witch worked. But it really worked when I always loved telling the story of working at the theater where we had the 2-week exclusive and you had to go. It was either Detroit or Toronto or Chicago, and that was it. So it was like a 5-hour drive either way. And people would come and they'd be like, oh, it's real. And I go, come on. If you disappeared in the woods and all they found was your footage, are your parents really that cynical to sign off to let filmmakers make a movie out of it?
Of course.
Really?
Yeah, that's what you do.
These days, it would open with World Star. I remember Blair Witch and that moment when he was standing in the corner. I'd been conditioned for jump scares for people to scream. And instead, there was just an inhale. It was like 300 people just inhaled and you could feel the blood drain from people. It was a chill rather than a scream, and you just knew that you were watching a film that was very, it felt unsafe.
More innocent time, 1999. Speaking of 1999, because this movie came out, it's not mentioned in the book, but Best Movie Year Ever is the title of the book. And it's a good survey of 1999, in which they say basically it was the last really interesting year of film, and they go into a history of why these kind of different threads all came together to make 1999 probably one of the more interesting years in cinema history.
All right, guys, let's go ahead and take a break and play a preview for next week's show right after these brief messages.
Remember the stories that kept you awake at night?
They're living in that closet, Dr. Fenner.
Can you still hear the screams?
I love having the children for dinner.
All from your television set.
In the night gallery.
A dark side.
Midnight Viewing, the horror anthology podcast. Join hosts Father Malone, Mike White, and Chris Stashew as they exhume some of the most infamous horror television of all time. Midnight Viewing. From Weirding Way Media.
Until next time.
I'll tell you one thing. Whoever set us up is really connected.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
Relax. Soak. And don't flatter yourself.
Meet Ray Tango. He likes money.
Easy come, easy go.
But doesn't bother with cash. Meet Gabe Cash. He won't dance around trouble and doesn't mind stepping on toes.
I hate you karate guys.
Two of LA's top rival cops are having a good time staying in rhythm.
You know me, huh?
Yeah, I hear you're the second best cop in LA.
That's funny. I hear the same thing about you.
But they're going to have to work together, even if it kills them.
Like now!
We'll take it.
No. That's one of a kind.
We won't put a scratch on it.
Did you sleep with my sister?
I was so drunk, I don't remember, okay?
Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell. Tango and Cash.
That's right. Next week, we're still in comedy month, but we're looking at Tango and Cash, which I guess is supposed to be funny. Until then, I want to thank this week's co-hosts, Rob and Kevin. So, Rob, what has been going on with you, sir?
Just living out in the high desert. I'm enjoying it and doing some writing, trying to learn some Espanol. And so I don't sound too much like a gringo at times. And enjoying life.
Muy bien.
Sí.
Y Kevin, how about yourself?
Just riding away for my sins and releasing episodes of my podcast with my more accomplished co-host, Will Collins. It's called The Best Bits. And yeah, you can find this wherever you listen to podcasts. Will's won a BAFTA and I've been nominated for a Razzie, and that's the gist of it. We just get together and talk about films.
Even each other out.
What I find really irritating is that he records with the BAFTA behind him. So I have to keep.
Oh,
and you didn't even win the Razzie, did you?
No, I didn't. No.
Oh, see.
I don't know. Is that considered a good thing or
I
bad?
I desperately wanted to win a Razzie. I've never won anything for writing, and to have won a Razzie is the first thing I'd ever, for anything I'd ever written. I would have dined out in that for the rest of my life, so I'm gutted. It was that Diana film that won instead.
That's just not fair. I think that whole thing is fixed myself.
That whole thing is bullshit, I think myself.
I don't know. Maybe you should have did one of those big carpet bombing PR campaigns.
For your consideration.
For your consideration, please vote for me for the Razzie. You really would have wanted then.
Sit up with a deck chair and a co. Vote for me. The thing is, I was a co-writer on that project with about 7 other writers, and I think the other 6 were mortified about being nominated, while I was just constantly telling everyone that I was nominated. So I was drawing more attention to the fact that the film that we were co-writers on was nominated for a Razzie, but I don't care about that stuff. It's good fun.
Some of the best movies that we've covered have been nominated for Razzie, so they have absolutely zero taste.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, guys, for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to hear more of me shooting off my mouth, please check out some of the other shows that I work on. They are all available at WeirdingWayMedia.com. Thanks especially to our Patreon community. If you want to join the community, visit patreon.com/projectionbooth. Every donation we get helps the projection booth take over the world.
Life's like a movie. Write your own ending. Keep believing. Keep pretending. We've done just what we've set out to do. Thanks to the lovers, the dreamers, and you.
Chocolate rain. A baby born will die before the sin. Chocolate rain. The school books say it can't be here again. Chocolate rain. The prisons make you wonder where it went. Chocolate rain. Build a tent and say the world is dry. Chocolate rain. Zoom the camera out and see the light. Chocolate rain. Still be falling yesterday. Chocolate rain. Only in the past is what they say. Chocolate rain. Raise your neighborhood insurance rates. Chocolate rain. Makes us happy living in a gay. Chocolate rain. Made me cross the street the other day. Chocolate rain. Made you turn your head the other way. Chocolate rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate rain. Using you to fall back down again. Chocolate rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate rain. Using you to fall back down again. Chocolate rain. Seldom mentioned on the radio. Chocolate rain. It's the fear your leaders car control. Chocolate rain. Worse than swearing, worse than calling names. Chocolate rain. Say it publicly and you're insane. Chocolate rain. No one wants to hear about it now. Chocolate Rain. It's real hard, it goes away somehow. Chocolate Rain makes the best of friends begin to fight. Chocolate Rain. But did they know each other in the light? Chocolate Rain. Every February washed away. Chocolate Rain stays behind as colors celebrate. Chocolate Rain. The same crime has a higher price to pay. Chocolate Rain. The judge and jury swear it's not the face. Chocolate Rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate Rain. Using you to fall back down again. Chocolate Rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate Rain. Using you to fall back down again. Chocolate Rain. Dirty secrets of economy. Chocolate Rain. Turns that body into GDP. Chocolate Rain. The Belka blames the baby's DNA. Chocolate Rain. But test scores are how much the parents make. Chocolate Rain. Flipping cars in France the other night. Chocolate Rain. Cleans the sewers out beneath Mumbai. Chocolate Rain. Across the world and back, it's all the same. Chocolate Rain. Angels cry and shake their heads in shame. Chocolate Rain. Lifts the ark of paradise and sends Chocolate Rain. Which part do you think you're living in? Chocolate Rain. More than marching, more than passing law. Chocolate Rain. Remake how we got to where we are. Chocolate Rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate Rain. Using you to fall back down again. Chocolate Rain. History quickly crashing through your veins. Chocolate Rain. Using you to fall back down again.